When Ryan's, when it's time to begin, it's on the Rewind Around with John Pollock and Waiting the A-Team. That makes sense of these things we see in the ring every week on TV. It's Rewind Around for Monday night, downloaded Tuesday morning from the Post Wrestling site. It's Rewind Around for Monday night on USA Now on the John and Way. Take the mic.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Rewind to Raw, the 10 p.m. edition of the program, where Raw is over, the two-hour era is upon us, one down, at least 12 more to go. How do you feel, Wei?
I feel good. Yeah. My energy is good, I have to say. It's hard to talk about in some ways because I feel like I've just conditioned my body to to do these shows after 3 hour Raws for 12 years that I don't even really know what it's like to feel this way. But
I never conditioned myself over the last 12 years. This was glorious. I was just, as I was watching this show, just watching like the different pacing of the show in the back of my mind, it could not help but creep in that there ain't a prayer they're staying at this length when they go to Netflix. Like, they are not going to contain themselves to this 2 hours where you could feel like, just like, for instance, that Jey Uso Xavier Woods a week ago, that's getting like an extra segment on top of it. Like, that thing was 6 minutes, and you can just see, like, just trying to get faces onto the program when you have a lot. Like, 2 hours, it does go by. It fills up very quickly when you have this much talent to promote and programs to push.
Yeah, I mean, judging by Levesque's answer at the press conference, if we're supposed to take that as at face value, it seems like they're still weighing their options right now. And I'm assuming for these 12 weeks, they're going to take a lot of feedback from the audience to see what works. But ultimately, I think it'll be decided by how much ads they can sell, you know, or how much ads they can fit in while keeping a good pace of show for the audience.
I mean, it's all new territory of like what the structure of the show is going to be. Are ads just going to be embedded into the program? Are we going to have actual commercial breaks? It's all different territory that I'm sure they are still finalizing what this show is going to look like come January. But we will have plenty of time to talk about the move over to Netflix tonight. Let's just enjoy these two-hour Raws while we got them. A double taping tonight. They are taping more Raw. So that live audience in St. Louis, I mean, they're getting 4 hours of Raw tonight.
Yeah, when you're just talking about content for the second taping, maybe closer to a 3 hour. But, you know, it's probably an expensive ticket and they're getting their money's worth, I guess. Sexy Red is staying for, she's going to be consuming a lot of wrestling these next 2 days.
Yeah, she gets to hit the big stop on the tour of Chesterfield tomorrow. Again, identified as St. Louis tonight on the show.
Close enough, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, well, we have lots to get into tonight. We will get through Raw. We have news to get through. And also want to alert people, over the past weekend, a lot of great coverage on the site, both written and audio/video. We do have a review of Bad Blood, Waiting and I going through Saturday's show that took place from Atlanta, as well as a UFC 307 review that I did with Eric Marcotte on Sunday morning, chatting about Alex Pereira's latest light heavyweight title defense and a new bantamweight champion in Juliana Pena, who regained the championship. So those are just some of the shows you can catch from the past weekend. And also want to put a spotlight on Tuesday, because we are going to be dropping an extensive review that Karen Peterson has undertook going through the Queen of Villains series that is now available on Netflix, profiling Dump Matsumoto and the Crush Gals era of the All Japan Women period throughout the 80s. And she is going to be joined by JP from the Grapple Spotlight podcast as they will go through Matsumoto's career. And I know an extensive amount of research has gone into this show, and I'm looking forward to listening to it. And it drops exclusively for Post Wrestling Cafe members on Tuesday. $6 to sign up. An excellent bonus this month that you get from Karen and JP.
We give Karen an assignment, and she takes it very seriously, you know, especially with this sort of subject matter. She's somebody who just has spent a lot of time, you know, giving us background information on the history of these characters, and I think even a lot about the production itself as well, and a lot of the customs that really kind of go into some of the themes of this particular show. So those of you who have heard a lot of buzz about this show and have either watched it or have not watched it, consider listening to this and maybe making up your mind that way. Or if you have listened to it, I'm sure you'll get plenty out of this as well. So that'll be in the Post Wrestling Cafe tomorrow. And we might even consider releasing it at a future date for the public as well. But if you want to get it right away, join the Post Wrestling Cafe.
And it's a busy day on Tuesday because we do have the NXT and AEW Title Tuesday shows going down in the evening. So Brain and Davey are going to be doing their show at the usual start time, just after 10 p.m. Eastern time on the Post Wrestling feed. And then Wei and I are going to be going live about an hour or so later because Title Tuesday is airing from 9 till 11. So you'll get both our shows on Tuesday night / Wednesday morning, whenever you listen to them, going through all of that. So that's coming up over the next couple of days. We'll also be doing an Ask Away mailbag this week. So if you want to get your questions in, forum.postwrestling.com, just submit your question in the thread. We will get to the question. And as well, you can also drop us a audio question if you are so inclined. memo.fm/postwrestling, free to submit, and you can hear your wonderful voice on the Ask Away mailbag show. All right, let's get into some news coming out of Bad Blood. There were one notable injury that we can talk about, and that was to Drew McIntyre. And we talked about this match, Wei, and that one of the strengths was kind of the illusion of a lot of violence. Well, this was one where, I mean, this was the spot where we were discussing like the excessive amount of blood that Drew sustained. And this coming from the toolbox shot that just cracked him right on the crown of the head, resulting in 16 staples to be placed into his head. A remarkably similar injury that Finn Balor had the last time the company did a Hell in a Cell match, where it was a ladder thrown into Finn Balor's head by Edge. And if you remember, they had to shoot away from Finn Balor as they literally stapled him in the match.
Oh, crazy.
And continued it. Absolute insanity, that story. Now, this one, certainly more questions can be asked. Like, was the target the forehead to open up Drew? I mean, I have to imagine they were going for blood for both of them. They had promised this. Regardless of what the intent was, this was like a toolbox to the head. And I think that this is and a lot of this is just us coming off the Okada Shibata lengthy discussion we had last week. But this goes across for multiple companies, whether it is your lucha companies, whether it's in Japan, whether it's here. And like these headshots, like they are concerning. And it does appear that, you know, I don't know what the updated philosophy is when it comes to blading, or if they're still of this mindset that if we're going to do blood, we're going to bust each other open hard way. That's for the performers to answer what the point of this was. But you had a guy coming out of this with like a pretty brutal injury after this that to me felt like unnecessary if we're just whacking guys with toolboxes.
Hard for us to say without knowing what was planned, what was permitted. I'll have to say, I feel like if it was intentional to for CM Punk behind over top of his head, aiming somebody with the intent of busting them open with a toolbox. Wrestlers are magicians and they have incredible sleight of hand. But that feels like it would be a really lucky shot to me. If that was the intent and he actually got it. But blood was permitted prior to this anyway. So Could this just have been, again, something that you might consider fortunate in this particular context? Or if it was somehow something that's deliberate, I mean, maybe we'll find out later in the tell-all. But something tells me this was, you know, but listen, these types of like big injuries or big cuts, I think they're somewhat unavoidable in wrestling in many situations. Like, look at the Finn Balor one that you just mentioned. So should anything be done as a result of this? Like, should we take any sort of extra precaution in the future as a result of this? My gut feeling is that is the answer is no, because this just might be, you know, part of the danger of professional wrestling. So, you know, yes, like debates about like object being used to hit people in the head are going to persist maybe every single time that we see something like this, especially after the Paige sword match, especially after the CTE conversations coming out of Mr. McMahon. But by
the way, there were some of the testimonials. I retweeted this from John Nash's account, but in the Kung Lee case, there were a number of testimonials from past fighters, the likes of Vanderlei Silva, Shane Carwin, Kung Lee. Some really just terrible to read about, like some of the struggles these guys are going through now, not to like just completely deviate away. But I mean,
but is that I understand it could seem related to this. But wrestling as an art form is a recipe for CTE, just even when it's done, you know, like without this sort of weapon shot, you know, like taking a bad back bump is bad for CTE.
Don't tell Steve Austin this. Okay.
It's sure. I guess you'd be doing it wrong if you do, but I just don't know if you do anything about this to prevent it in the future, because I just think this stuff is kind of part of wrestling. That might sound controversial to some, and you know what? I opened up the debate.
I just feel like there's enough ways around certain things that just like, blunt force shots to the head are one that I think like there are enough. There's just so many ways around it that I think pro wrestling does give you a lot of advantages to get around and get to the same result. I'm not anti blood. I'm not like anti weapon shots. I think that they can all be done in just a strategic way. And for all we know, this could have been just a mistake. And those are going to happen. You can't prevent those from happening.
Exactly. Yeah, it could be that.
All right. Another big topic coming out of the Bad Blood press conference was a question that was posed to Chief Content Officer Paul Levesque. And this was regarding black representation on WWE premium live events. We're going to play that clip and then we are going to welcome on someone to chat with us. So here is Paul Levesque being asked this question at the Bad Blood press conference.
Regarding the representation of black male wrestlers within WWE, they haven't been on a PLE in the last three cards. There was no black male wrestlers on the Bad Blood card. How do you gauge between making sure that there's representation and making sure that there are wrestlers that get opportunities that are deserved?
I see everybody gets the opportunity. Like if I don't see the difference in anybody, I don't see the color. I don't see the nationality. I don't see any of it. I just see talent. I don't see the difference between men and women. I see talent. We tell stories with those talent, how they can handle those stories and how they can represent those stories and how we can bring those stories forward. So, you know, I don't keep track of any of that. I do what's relevant and what is best in the best in storytelling and what's being delivered the best. And then that's what goes. No different than, you know, the men and the women who main events, whatever the biggest stories are, that's where we go.
Those are the words of Paul Levesque, which have been heavily discussed in the day or so since that press conference took place. Joining us now, one of the co-hosts of the NWA podcast that can be heard on the Post Wrestling Network each and every month. Joining us here at a relatively early hour on the West Coast with the new Raw format, Chris from LA, Chris Ely is with us, the doctor himself. So, Chris, just listening back to that comment, I mean, I'm sure you heard it Saturday night and the response. Listening back to that, what are you hearing when or maybe what are you not hearing from Paul Levesque in that response that he is asked about at the press conference?
Well, I mean, for me, it's just kind of par the course. I wasn't like floored or anything by it. WWE. Wrestling in general, they've had this kind of history of this kind of colorblind racism. And I always explain to people privilege, and people kind of overthink what privilege is. They think about it as the things that you have. I usually define privilege to those that want to listen as the things that you don't have to think about, you know, the things that you could go through life without having to worry about. And I don't think Triple H necessarily means harm by those comments, but that's how wrestling is looked at by upper management. And I don't think there are too many black wrestlers that are rushing to tell management, hey, I would rather be booked in this way, or I think I fit best in this storyline. I don't know the amount of agency any of these cats think that they have. So it's unfortunate that in 2024, that's still the mindset, but it ain't no big surprise, right?
Chris, so, you know, you mentioned maybe like you don't necessarily think there was ill intent in Levesque's answer. I think like this sort of answer seems to me like, you know, like he is saying it from what he considers to be like a morally right place. And in some ways, like this is even the sort of lesson that is taught to all of us from a young age. Hey, like treat everybody equally, you know, don't see color. Can you explain to somebody who might not understand why this was controversial, why this might seem somewhat insensitive today?
Right. So, like, treating everybody equally sounds well in theory, but we're not equal, right? That's just not the nature of how things are, you know? I recently became part of the disabled community. And for the longest time, I had the privilege of not having to like map out my every move when I go out. So if I explain to one of my friends, hey, this is what I'm working with right now. You know, I need ramps. I need walkways. I need to be able to, you know, grab things and stuff like that. And my friend was just like, yeah, you'll get around. Everyone's getting around a certain way. That's, you know, that's not the attitude that would like do me any good in a vulnerable situation. And I think that just with wrestling in general, this is the attitude. You know, this is the attitude is we're giving you an opportunity to be on TV, to have a dream job that you normally wouldn't have. We're paying you well. Do your job and you'll be on TV or whatever. And I just don't think there's a lot of thought that goes into black talent. And it could just be a relatability thing. I think maybe Triple H feels he doesn't necessarily need to relate to these people because he's not thinking of it from that point of view. I mean, you know, it's funny because he was in that famous angle with Booker T a long time ago. And he definitely saw race in doing that stuff. So, I mean, I just, you know, it's insensitive. You know, as wrestlers, as fans, we just have to figure out how much of this stuff we're going to indulge, you know?
I think, so you bring that up, and this sort of controversy, I guess you could call it, over the past 48 hours has sort of unearthed on social media, you know, other things like that Levesque has done on screen in the past, like DX in blackface, famously, of course. We can also maybe point to certain things that MVP has alluded to prior to his or before his exit officially from the WWE that may be directly pointing fingers at Paul Levesque and maybe his racial insensitivity, we could say. Do you think this is now like a trait that's attached to Levesque and should be something that more members of the media should be questioning him on and audiences should be questioning him on?
Well, yeah, I definitely think this is a trait that's attached to him. I think it's a well-deserved trait. I think he doesn't know how to talk to the media. He's got very bad media training. This is just, you know, like Levesque, he's one of those privileged guys that doesn't understand that they're privileged. One of my favorite directors from back in the day, David Mamet. He directed Glengarry Glen Ross, a good movie. And he went on this rant about a year or two ago where he was talking about how he hated how everything had to be DEI and nobody is privileged and all this other stuff. And his daughter is now getting into directing. And he's like, my daughter doesn't have any privilege. And it's like, dude, you are David Mamet and your daughter is directing. So you've got privilege. Like Triple H has benefited from privilege ever since he started dating Stephanie McMahon and then later married her. So he got the privilege of nepotism. And I think a lot of him, because people probably tell him this, is like, oh, everything you've got is on your own merits, you know? So I think that's the mindset he comes from. And privilege is one of those things that you really have to kind of step outside of yourself and look back at the situation. And then you're like, man, I'm privileged. And a lot of us don't necessarily do that. And I think, I definitely think Levesque is one of those people. Like, you put people in the black talent on WWE, and I watched tonight's Raw for the first time in forever, and kudos to them for ending it early. But, you know, you like when black talent are put in these situations, I know a lot of them wear the burden of the race on their back. And for me, people, like when I see R-Truth on Raw acting like an imbecile all the time, you know, people are entertained by that, but I can't help but think of how that looks for the race as a whole. And then after that, I think about how many black talent does WWE have that are doing anything of note, and that adds an extra layer to it. You know, maybe you'd be able to excuse someone like R-Truth if there were other talent there that was doing things, but when there's such little black representation, I do have to side eye it a little bit.
Is this a case, Chris, as well, that it's more so that, like, has something changed recently that has added to a hyper focus on this, or do you feel like this has been a longer term issue when it comes to the representation of black talent? And you're looking specifically at the main roster, where a Bobby Lashley has left the company, an MVP has left the company, Big E has, you know, his career is on standstill. And you seem, it just appears to me to be not so much just looking at a particular pay-per-view card and checking off a box that there's representation there. This is a larger issue of what are the available storylines to a lot of these talents, and right, are they really reaching that audience that I think there is some listening involved too, of like an audience that doesn't feel it's being written for.
Yeah, exactly. Like there's there's the thing with optics too, right? It's like, if I didn't know better, I'd be like, hey, why does WWE has a bunch of like guys on the roster in their late 40s? Why is Bobby Lashley the one you can't think of anything salient with, right? What's going on there? What did Bobby Lashley do to where, why can't he be somebody that's feuding with Bron Breakker? Why can't he be in a feud with Cody Rhodes or, you know, whoever else, Gunther or whatever? And it's a problem, you know, because it's something that historically this company has done with black talent. And when you hear Triple H just flippantly say, I don't see color, it's like, Yeah, of course. You know, it's like, you know, I think I don't think Triple H is like a card carrying member of the clan, but maybe he has the black guys he likes. And maybe he just doesn't think that much of it. Like, a few weeks ago, I haven't been watching Raw like live regularly for a while, but I remember they did something with New Day. What's the guy's name? Odyssey Jones. They like just inserted him in that mix. And I'm watching this and like, outside of being black, what do these guys have in common? You know, it's like, what's the common thread between them? Am I missing something? Is this just, you know, we're putting black people together because we can't think of anything else to do with them, you know? I don't think WWE cares about anything like about racial sensitivity or anything like that, or the politics or the optics. Even with The Rock being back in the company, The Rock, he got scared a couple of years when he endorsed Biden 4 years ago. This year he's like, I caused division or whatever the fuck he said. But I mean, I just don't think that if we're looking for diversity in WWE, I just don't think that's something that we're going to get. So the question we have to ask ourselves, is this something we want to continue to indulge, or are we going to say something about it, or is this a wrestling industry problem as a whole? And how do we want to approach it? Before I stop, there was I know a few of those a few black journalists who attend those pressers who are afraid to ask those questions, because after WWE does a good PLE, they don't want to be the person to like put shade on the mood. You know, they don't want to be the person that's like,
oh, by all means, never ruin the mood. Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll
exactly.
Not be happy. No. The mood right. Is of the utmost importance to uphold.
Right. Yeah. That's the thing. And it's like, and that's kind and this, and it brings into question, what are the point of these like press conferences? Right. I do hope that Triple H, one, he's like, he can't do he can't answer media questions. I think that's apparent now. Get somebody that can do it. I don't know if they want to go as far as doing like racial sensitivity training, if they like how many blacks they've got on the writing staff, whatever. But that, I mean, Ari Emanuel knows better than this. You know, these people know that, you know, it's not as simple as, especially in a sport that's not real. You know, you can kind of like manipulate things to be what you need them to be, you know.
So you bring up, I guess, Levesque, you know, in his press conferences, and how we always seem to come out of these at least with something that maybe we can criticize him for answering improperly. And somebody who did the prior press conference in his place was Cody Rhodes. And just as I think coincidence would have it, Cody has actually given his thoughts on this particular topic in the past, in saying at a prior AEW conference, I told Randy one time that I don't see color, and she said, well, then you don't see my experience.
Right.
What's sort of your interpretation of what he means by this answer, and what Brandy meant by what she said, and how do you maybe compare and contrast to like how Levesque answered this one?
Yeah, I think the way Cody, like, that was a genuine response. And I remember when he gave that answer, and I really do appreciate it from the standpoint that he even admitted that he said that to Brandy. You know, you are trying to, you know, get with a black woman, so you need to understand the intricacies of the woman that you want to be with. And I do think that's kind of open Cody's eyes to other things. And Triple H is just again, he's married to a Greenwich socialite, right? He's in privilege. He's over, he lives in, to quote Jim Ross, an overpriced hellhole called Greenwich, Connecticut. You know, he's got privilege all around him. It'd be nice if he wanted to be on the outside looking in and say, you know, just ask the talent what's going on with them, pick their brain. I don't think that's something anybody in WWE wants to do. I think they're all happy living in their bubble. I think they, again, the relationship with wrestlers and management in that company is transactional. I remember a few weeks ago when Mark Henry, when he made an allusion to the woman that's suing Vince McMahon, and he said, well, everything was fine when she was getting the money. And it made sense coming from Mark Henry. It was still a disgusting comment, but Mark Henry understands accepting money to do degrading things. And he's like, and because he's done a lot of degrading things on TV, they were at one point calling him a silverback gorilla. You know, he did kind of, you know, finally say, hey, don't do that. But it's one of those, like, this is how, if as long as talent treat this relationship like that, I don't see it going away. Until talent, like, get some agency and be like, look, man, this is, why am I in doing this stupid stuff? Why aren't there any black main eventers at the moment? Is what's going on? You know, just you, until talent feels that they could ask questions, this is just what it is, you know?
Yeah. And I think that if you're looking at least for a contrast, like, I would not assign all of this to the entire company. When you look at NXT, that to me has blossomed some incredible talent that you mm-hmm. are seeing on a weekly basis, from your Trick Williams, Kalani Jordan, Javon Evans, Jada Parker, like, you can go on, and there are a lot of great quality performers that could be on the come up to the main roster. But I feel like this is a subject that is routinely looked upon, and it seems to be one that overall, I think it is one where if you're a Paul Levesque, you do want to be listening to these criticisms, and privately, maybe he does after something like this. But I think, like, it's a answer that I'm sure he gave that answer thinking to, like, Wei's point, that he was giving, like, this safe answer. But I think, like, that should be an eye opener too about, you know, a portion of the audience that you are not truly going to be able to understand unless you really try and listen and understand from a completely different life experience than one that you have had.
Right. Yeah. I think the lesson for a lot of these people should be, anytime you try to play it safe, anytime you try to give a non-answer, or you try to be apolitical in a situation like this, somebody's going to always be pissed off at you. That's just the nature of the beast. And I think the problem with, and I do agree with you, Pollock, but the thing with NXT is this has always been a thing with NXT. I see black wrestlers get pushed on NXT all the time. And then when it's time to go to the main roster, they get lost in the shuffle. Not necessarily the woman, Bianca Belair and Sasha Banks, when she was there, she got a decent sizable push. But for a lot of these guys, they do great stuff in NXT, Big E one of them, and then they go to the main roster and they're kind of languishing for a little while. And if it happens more than a few times, it becomes more than coincidence. It becomes, okay, what's really going on, my dude? It's like, is it just NXT where the black guys go to get pushed, and then when they go to the main roster, is it where they go to get lost in the shuffle? I don't know, and I hope that's not true. I mean, how many times can Carmelo Hayes and Andrade wrestle each other? You know, this is, but it harkens back to how many times can Kofi Kingston and Dolph Ziggler wrestle each other? So nothing's, you know, history doesn't repeat, it rhymes. So, you know.
Well, I know that I'm sure this topic will be coming up this month on the NWA podcast, which will be coming out October the 20th. So mark down your Sunday night and just put all your other plans to the side as Chris will be getting together with Nate Milton, Andrew Thompson, and of course, Two-Way Ray. Chris, we want to thank you very much for jumping on with us. And it's always great to hear your perspective, especially on topics like this. And we know it's a very busy time for you as we are. We're about a month out from the big day.
Yeah, election day, midterms, finals, all kinds of stuff. Yeah, and I actually, right before I got on this call, sorry I was a little late, I was just finishing up the NWA podcast from last month. So that's why I'm a little late. So forgive me for that.
Well, we hope you're all caught up on your own program. So it's always a great time hearing from all of you. So October 20th is the next NWA podcast. Have a good one, Chris, and thanks for making some time for us tonight.
All right. Peace out, y'all. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris.
All right. Well, we thank Chris for joining us. That was the big topic coming out of the press conference. And I do wonder, like, I don't like that this is kind of like the end discussion that a lot of people have, but it is one that was like posed to me today, and it's not like I have a great answer to it. And it is why WWE continue doing these press conferences. And it seems that, you know, the answer you and I tend to come to is, well, there are sponsorship opportunities. Like, you could package this thing in their post-show format, and it eliminates these moments that happen with, you know, a fair degree of regularity for Paul Levesque this year. Like, is the juice worth the squeeze for these press conferences for WWE when, like, what is your thought on them continuing to do these? And do you feel like they're, or maybe is this,
they clearly think so. I mean, they've been stubborn about keeping these up every single month. Right. So there's got to be some value to it that maybe we don't necessarily even see on the surface. Maybe they just want to be nice to the media members that do show up by, you know, enticing them to ask these sort of questions and then potentially getting some of these headlines. I don't think they've really done much to, like, curb, you know, these sort of questions from being asked, you know, other than maybe for some of the bigger shows, curating, you know, the types of people that might show up. But for the most part, I feel like they've been pretty consistent. And I mean, I can't really speak for them, but we could speculate about them not necessarily being that bothered by some of this press, perhaps. You know, maybe they just don't think it's that big of a deal, or even if it is, they might not necessarily think it's either warranted criticism or maybe questions that they just, I don't know, aren't so concerned about. But beyond that, maybe the value might be just some form of legitimacy, you know, like, hey, we're like a big sport, and all big sports have these sort of press conferences and relationships with the media, so we're going to keep doing them. That's about as much as I can guess.
Like, I'm never going to, you know, champion less access. I mean, I'm glad they happen for all your criticisms mm-hmm. you might want to have of these press conferences. When you do get some actual insightful questions and sometimes insightful answers, I mean, they're very noteworthy, because you don't really have those open, on the record types of conversations with an executive in the company. And that goes for both companies. Like, they both continue to do this. And yeah, they're not always the most ideal circumstances. You don't always get the most clear, transparent answers, but it's a lot better than being completely closed off.
Yeah. Yeah. I do appreciate whatever the media member was that asked it, because it's allowed, it's brought this topic to the wrestling community. And I can tell from our chat room, it is not a topic that many people are going to necessarily agree on, but it does open the conversation. So I find that, like, a lot more worthwhile to come out of these press conferences with than simply, you know, just the question about, like, hey, like, what's your next step in your storyline, for instance, you know? Keep the conversation going. I you know, but please do it respectfully is all we ask.
Just the other news items. Braun Strowman did confirm he has a torn groin, which really came as no surprise when we saw the state of him in that last Monster Standing match last week. No, it wasn't on Raw tonight. No word on, you know, time away. But I mean, he showed a video of this. This did not look like a pleasant injury. But I mean, credit to this guy that, I mean, this was very early in the match and they went about 20. And they had to do a lot. Like, this was not a match where you could just, you know, cut corners, and they had to do a lot of physical stuff in that match, and doing it with a torn groin is, I mean, it had to be immense pain that he was working through for a not insignificant amount of time.
I can't imagine doing half. I can't imagine walking in that state, much less like doing half the stuff that he did, including climbing up the top turnbuckle in order to deliver that final big spot break in the ring. So,
I mean, hopefully he didn't do any more damage, like, from the amount of stuff he did in that match. I mean, it was it was a very physical match and he's a big guy doing these incredible things.
Yeah, though this is one of those instances where I think you would have had to take his leg off in order to get him to stop this match. This was the culmination of their feud with Bronson Reed, and he could take the time off now, you know, that fits in with the storyline and the character. I hope if there's any sort of silver lining coming out of any of these sorts of injuries, especially for a babyface, I hope they could use that to sort of push the legend of that match and to push Braun Strowman as a babyface coming out of this. Give him his, you know, Triple H torn quad moment.
They're going to start the U2 song to Braun Strowman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
SmackDown rating on Friday night, 1,518,000 viewers and a 0.47 in the demo. First on cable, second on television behind, you guessed it, Fox's coverage of Michigan State and Oregon. So the Friday night battles continue. They were also up against college football and two WNBA playoff games. They were down 3% in viewers, but up 4% in the demo from the week prior. Rampage, and this was an interesting one to look at because this did feature the Young Bucks in a rare Rampage match. 216,000 viewers and a 0.07. So a 22% drop in viewers, 17% decline in the demo, 17th in primetime on cable, and their lowest numbers since August the 2nd. So the I'm sure when we see the quarter breakdowns, I'm going to assume the first quarter would have been the highest, which was where the Bucks and Jack Perry were in the six man, but did not spike the number as a whole. As Rampage, it seems like they're its days are numbered, at least on TNT.
Whatever Rampage does, does it tell you much about anything about the content at all, or does it not?
I mean, I think it's a show at this point that it is like, listen, I would say like a Young Bucks match is about as high profile of a match as you're going to see featured on a Rampage, and it's kind of a lame duck show at this point. So I don't know how much focus you put into this unless you have designs of trying to sell this elsewhere. But that's kind of where things are with Rampage. I don't think it really changes the priority level. It's been very low. If anything, it was surprising that you put a Young Bucks match on that short notice for Friday, as opposed to like your show that is sticking around in a collision.
Can they try to get a big number out of the final Rampage?
Oh, I mean, could they do 300,000 viewers? Maybe
the last dance.
The final dance, yes, yeah. Potentially. And then Tuesday night, these are our lineups. NXT will start off the night at 8 Eastern from Chesterfield, Missouri. Randy Orton against Javon Evans. Obafemi against Tony D'Angelo for the North American title. Axiom and Nathan Frazier against A-Town Down Under for the NXT tag titles. Bianca Belair, Jade Cargill, and Kalani Jordan taking on Fatal Influence. We'll get appearances by Trick Williams, Roxanne Perez, Cora Jade, and Sexy Red for the second night in a row.
Big show. One of two big shows for the CW debut. We'll see how they do.
And Title Tuesday starts at 9 Eastern, so we will get each show with an unopposed hour. Title Tuesday featuring, as of now, Bryan Danielson and Wheeler Yuta against Claudio Castagnoli and Pac. Britt Baker and Willow Nightingale. Winner will challenge Mariah May at WrestleDream this Saturday. Mercedes Moné defends the TBS and Strong Women's Championships against Amy Sakura. Hook will call out the attacker who forced his father to have total knee replacement surgery. And Darby Allin and Brody King will have a face-to-face segment. I thought for sure that at some point, maybe tonight, we were going to get one of Tony Khan's graphic drops for something else on this show. I'm just not feeling this Tuesday show at all. It just feels like it's a show.
Agreed. Especially coming off of last week, you know, and really like the average type of maybe billing you get for a Dynamite, this doesn't feel like it's a big effort match, you know. Like, I'm a big fan of Amy Sakura. I'm sure, you know, the match with Monet, I have an interest in, just because I know how big of a deal it will be for Amy Sakura. But it's not a Dynamite level match, in my opinion. Like, certainly they could have used storyline to get us there, but they've not done that at all, at least not on last week's Dynamite. And you know, this Danielson Yuta story with the BCC is compelling, but I don't know, there's not that big hook just yet. And I don't mean the wrestler.
I know. We'll wait. I know. And this is the go home show for Wrestle Dream on top of that. And I mean, I want to see after these 2 hours, like, how hard they hit the fact, like, Danielson's potentially like last full time match at the Tacoma Dome this Saturday, which is a very real possibility with Moxley. Like, I'd be very surprised if Moxley is losing this match on Saturday. And I don't feel like you have dialed that up to make it really feel that urgent, but we will see what they have in store for this go home show.
Yeah.
Coming up this month on the Post Wrestling Cafe, we are bringing you 3 editions of Rewind Away, beginning with New Japan's Sakura Genesis from April of 2017 and the highly controversial match between Kazuchika Okada and Katsuyori Shibata. Later this month, we'll go back to October of 1987 with WWF's Saturday Night's main event on NBC, including title matches between Hulk Hogan and Sika, Honky Tonk Man against Randy Savage, and the Hart Foundation facing the Young Stallions. The month rounds out with WWE's Money in the Bank 2011. With CM Punk challenging John Cena for the WWE Championship in Chicago after the pipe bomb promo. Plus, Karen Peterson presents a special show focusing on the Queen of Villains on Netflix, weekly editions of Rewind to SmackDown and Collision Course, ad-free shows, news and audio updates sent directly to your email, and so much more, beginning at $6 per month, which provides instant 30-day access and extensive archives going back to 2017. PostWrestlingCafe.com. All right, all your news can be found over at postwrestling.com. Again, a reminder that the Queen of Villains review dropping at postwrestlingcafe.com on Tuesday with Karen Peterson and JP. But tonight, we are on to night one in the state of Missouri in St. Louis at the Enterprise Center. WrestleTix reporting 8,189 tickets out. Now, WrestleTix always notes what they drew the last time they were at said arena. And for the Raw back in February, they were down 18% for this one. So, I mean, you're not going to look disappointingly at 8,200 tickets, but just interesting to see, like, it was, you know, a not insignificant decline from the last time they were in the market here in St. Louis. And also, like, this was where NXT was going to be in this building the next night, and they had to move that one because of the just not a lot of demand for NXT the next night.
Yeah, I mean, the show in February, this is, right? Is that what you said, John?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's WrestleMania season, you know.
It is a bigger season, but it's still like we're still in the midst of like a hot period, but you're right. Like, this
not
is
as hot. So I'm sure that maybe that's just what they might consider justification for this decrease, which like you said, is rare. But would you still say this was a healthy number, unhealthy?
This was 8,200 is still a very, very healthy number. Yeah, like, I'm not painting this as like a disappointment, just worth noting the differences as we're seeing. And then relatively quick turnaround, too. And again, they were like aiming for back-to-back nights here at this arena. So we start off, as only we could, following Bad Blood, with Sexy Red in the ring, pretty much just to welcome us to Raw, and we cut to a Bad Blood video, interesting to see the way that they showed the recap. It positioned Punk and Drew as the last match to highlight, as though it was the main match of the show, which for the purposes of Raw, it should be positioned that way. And it also led to CM Punk walking out.
Yeah, it could really just be that, you know, just as it was the Raw main event, and it directly transitioned to our opening segment. And I think for a lot of people, like, this is the match that this show will be remembered for.
Punk walks out and he is bandaged up. He looks all beaten down from the Hell in a Cell and says he's in no condition to be here. It hurts to smile. but he had to come here to see the people. He doesn't feel like a winner, and he's not sure where he goes after this. He said, I didn't have another Hell in a Cell left in me, and I didn't. He thanks three sets of people. First, his ride or die fans, the ones that chanted my name for 7 years for me to come back to wrestling and then waited another three for me to come home. I mean, what a just putting the dagger in as much as he can.
He had to spend 3 years at what he thought was his home.
Yeah, before it was late. He went in the back door, and it turned out that his key turned in, but he went into the wrong house. You know,
are you saying AEW was like the porch to WWE for CM Punk?
It was, you know, it was late, and he went into the wrong home for 3 years, and then
somebody else's house,
and then he was evacuated from that house and had to go to the next one. Mm-hmm. He wants to thank his peers in front and behind the camera. And third, the people that don't like me at all. It's a thin line between love and hate, and I turned your hate into cash. So thank you. And for those that keep doubting me, keep doing it. And he's off to see his wife. He has not seen her in 5 weeks and doesn't know when he'll be back. And out walks Seth Rollins to just walk past Punk and briefly have a face-to-face. And this felt like this was the temporary write-off of CM Punk. And and wouldn't you know it, looks like he will probably not be going to Saudi Arabia.
Well, I think that is the answer to a pretty significant question that we've had about CM Punk, his return to WWE. A man who's been vocal about WWE's relationship with Saudi Arabia in the past.
He was injured during the last one, so didn't do that one.
When the time came, would he have a spot on a Saudi Arabia show? And I think this leads you to think that he would not be. In fact, the lower third crawl later on at the end, recapping the show, said something like specifically stating that CM Punk is going to take some time off after a hellacious, those exact words, Hell in a Cell match.
So Rollins is out, and he wishes Punk to get well soon so that I can kick his ass and retire him for good. He says hell has frozen over with Cody teaming with Reigns, and he makes mention of Kevin Owens punching Cody, but we're not supposed to talk about that. So he moves on. And based on the handling of this angle from Saturday, where Kevin Owens attacked Cody Rhodes and it was caught on all these fans on their phones, they are treating this the same way as the whole CM Punk Elite locker room fight. Like, it's this thing we're not supposed to be talking about, but they are driving you to Friday, where Cody said, I'm sure they'll talk about it on SmackDown. But tonight, they presented it like when Wade tried to discuss it, Joe Tessitore shut him down. It was like, we're not supposed to talk about this and just refer to Paul Levesque's statement. I completely believe like that is the influence for this angle.
Interesting. Okay. So wait, are we supposed to be believing? Like, because they're not treating this like this was like an out of character fight. No, this, they are alluding to it enough, like Sami Zayn alluding to it to Cody, you know, on screen. So I don't get the sense that they're trying to tell us that this was a shoot, but maybe something that, because it was sort of
they're trying to convey that this was not your typical wrestling angle.
Right. Like, they didn't want to glorify, you know, two of their wrestlers fighting each other in the back.
Yeah. I think they are trying to kind of convince you that this was like, they never showed the footage of it. And, you know, it's for your audience to go out there. Like, did WWE ever put out the footage on its own, or was it just fan footage?
No, I don't think so. But yeah, but they do mention it.
Yeah. I mean, they had Levesque acknowledge it.
I understand. I wanted to just maybe add an element of like, hey, like, this is something you have to kind of go out of your way to find. You know, in modern sort of like professional wrestling storytelling using multimedia avenues, I think it's great. I think
awesome. Thought it was really smart the way they did it. I thought it was really well done. Mm-hmm. Then he acknowledges Bronson Reed, who is not here tonight. So he looks into the camera and says that Reed almost ended his career with six tsunamis. He's going to give him his 15 minutes of fame and challenges him anywhere, anytime. And this time I'll be expecting you. So a lot of people not accounted for on this show when you consider no Drew McIntyre on the show, no Bronson Reed, Braun Strowman is hurt, CM Punk is off. So yeah, a lot of people that were, but on a 2-hour show, I can't say they were necessarily missed because they had enough to fill time with.
Yeah, that's a good point. The 2 hours might account for that. Have you seen spoilers for the second set of tapings yet?
No, because they're probably going on as we speak. Okay. I haven't seen any yet.
So they could appear on the second show potentially.
Yeah, I could see this being another Saudi Arabia match with Seth and Bronson.
Seth and Bronson Reed?
Yes.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. It could be TV, but yeah, I agree with you. I see. Saudi Arabia. They gave us several teasers of future programs here. You know, Punk and Rollins is something that I can see being for a Survivor Series. That's probably when we'll see CM Punk come back for a big program. You have to expect Punk will have a spot on a show like that. I think we also got a little bit of a tease on this segment crossover here between Rollins and Jey Uso.
Yes, we have Jey Uso coming out for his match, and Seth Rollins looks very annoyed that he is being interrupted after he did the exact same thing to CM Punk moments ago. And Jey pretty much takes over the ring, and Rollins leaves, and he's looking pretty pissed off at this. So yeah, there was the hint of that. So Rollins set up 3 matches in 10 minutes for himself.
Pretty impressive. Yeah, very economical use of, I guess, limited now 2-hour Raw TV time for Seth Rollins coming in and setting up several programs, both PLE level and potentially TV level. Now, with Jey, this one felt so kind of fleeting that I can see this being a tease for a longer-term program. This is a potential WrestleMania-level program, I think, you know, given Jey's trajectory and Rollins being, you know, at the level that he is. I think it would be a perfect way to showcase Jey Uso at a WrestleMania level. Now, the only question is, would one of these guys turn heel by that point to make that match work? And of the two, if anybody's turning heel, I could see Rollins doing it.
Well, Jey defended the Intercontinental title against Xavier Woods. After the commercial break, they're trading strikes, and Jey hits a flying forearm, is hit with a super kick. Woods gets a 2 count, and then Woods does his leap off the top for the elbow, but is met with a super kick and follows with the Uso splash, and Jey pins him in 6 minutes and 32 seconds. This match went so quickly. 6.5 minutes and like 3.5 were in commercial. Kofi is then checking on Kofi, but gives his respect to Jey, and Jey offers his hand. Xavier Woods rejects him, and then he's berating Kofi. Why did you shake his hand? And this was the first match of the show, and to me it was like whiplash here of okay, we're in a different format now, because this was very fast.
Very much so, yeah. Maybe a sign of things to come for these next 12 weeks. And some people may look at this and feel that it's unfortunate that we might have gotten robbed of like a more lengthier match. I tended to think like there was not much sort of suspense about who was going to win this one anyway. So I think the emphasis should always be first and foremost on the narrative that's carrying these storylines. And this was enough to achieve that.
And with Jey celebrating in the ring, Bron Breakker jumps him with a spear. It was a total 180 from last week, where he was giving his respect to Jey, and this week just throws that out the window, spears Jey, then he runs around the ring and spears Woods, and also lays out Kofi as well, then gives a second spear to Woods. So Braun one-upping Seth by also setting up his own 3 matches in even less time.
Yes, yes. We should also mention, like, at the moment of Braun attacking Jey, you had Kofi clearly wanting to save Jey, which he eventually did, but Woods trying to pull Kofi back, saying, hey, I don't like this guy right now.
Right, you know, yeah, yeah. Kofi was trying to help him, and yeah, Woods did not want to assist Jey.
So later on, they did announce Kofi versus Bronson Reed, and I'm sorry, Kofi, I don't think
Braun Breakker.
Oh, sorry, Braun Breakker. Duh, I'm going to do that a lot. Kofi versus Braun Breakker, and I'm sorry, Kofi, that doesn't look too good for you. But it's very interesting what they're doing with Braun. You know, after the segment last week where he came out, shook Jey's hand, and challenged Gunther, essentially, you know, for a future title shot, this week he's fully reverting back to being a heel. And so was last week just a misdirect in several segments?
This felt very abrupt. Like, it felt as though we were putting a pin in the Jey stuff, and now we're just it looks like we're revisiting all of it with Braun. I don't think the Gunther thing was done for no reason, though.
Sure. Like, so was there a change of course somewhere in the, over the past week, or was this always the plan? You know, well,
I'd be curious when they finalized the plan for what Crown Jewel was going to be. You would think it was thought of more than a week in advance. But I mean, like, certainly I didn't feel they were going to do Braun and Gunther like next week. But yeah, this did feel kind of abrupt with Braun. Like, we're going backwards after establishing him and kind of moving on from this.
But Jay versus Braun, I think, is definitely a worthwhile rematch to do on a show like a Crown Jewel, for instance. And clearly they are also using Braun just as further reasons for Kofi and Woods to turn on each other, or at least Woods to turn on Kofi.
There was a Rhea Ripley video stating that Liv can't beat her by herself. Also absent from this show, Rhea and Damian Priest. And Liv can't beat her by herself. You needed Raquel Rodriguez, and that guarantees another beating. So this feud will continue. Viking Raiders message, and then Breakers backstage.
So apparently they, I'm just going to say it. They came back on the second taping.
Way.
Yeah.
Oh, that in the main event segment, the final thing on the show.
I don't know about that. I don't think so.
Did they close the show? The Rock came out and he's part of the Viking Raiders. No,
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, that's next week. Jackie Redmond tried to interview Breaker. He did not answer. Just walk past them. And then we had these series of videos with these obvious technical glitches in them where they replayed Paul Levesque's announcement of the Crown Jewel champion versus champion matches. And then we go to a shot of Cody arriving and they've got these technical glitches. And then later we get a segment with Karrion Kross and The Miz. And this one is more overt that this is a Wyatt thing. But this didn't lead anywhere on this show. I thought we were getting some payoff to all of this by the end of the night.
So the Wyatt clip aside, which obviously was just kind of their gimmick, I don't think what you saw prior was part of the show. I think they were just actual technical glitches.
Well, the fact these all came together, maybe I'm conflating all of this, but I just felt it was all part of the same thing.
I just thought it was a rare case of them actually like something fucking up with their VTR or something and them.
Well, now they have cushioned themselves from any criticism and they can just say it was for the Wyatts.
I could even see them saying, hey, like we just had a bunch of actual glitches. Let's just throw the Wyatt thing in there so people might think it's part of the story. I could see that happening, you know, but yeah, it's just a rare case of like, you know, it's live TV. This sort of stuff happens. It happens very rarely for the WWE, but for me, it was like a case where I could like to see how Tessitore and Barrett could, fill in the gaps and to just like improvise on the fly, or at least like, I'm sure taking crazy commands in their headsets on the fly. And I thought they did a pretty good job.
Well, this is where Wade tries to bring up the Cody Owens thing and Joe Tessitore cuts him off, says, I know what you're referring to, and I don't want you to go down that road. Instead, I think we should just stick to Paul's statement. And he reads the post.
I would love to see a camera like either in Gorilla or in the control room during moments like this. It's always the most exciting when something goes wrong.
Karrion Kross is with The Miz, and this is where we clearly get a Wyatt's interruption. And Miz explains he did not attack R-Truth because of the final testament. He did it for himself. Thank goodness. Truth walks in and explains Miz must have been confused and admits, I am not part of Judgment Day any longer. So he forgives Miz. Miz says, I was not confused. Awesome Truth is done. And Truth says, I'm going to fix this. I'm going to go get us a match with Pierce. And Miz says, no, that's the problem. If you want a match, we can have one next week. Me against you.
Mm-hmm.
And St. Louis erupted. Like, we're getting that? Because next week is next hour.
Yes,
they gave this a standing ovation after this pre-tape.
Yeah, so I mean, last week's turn felt like pretty violent, you know, from The Miz attacking a best friend. And this week, I thought it was actually really funny what they did with Truth by saying, hey, I know why you did that. You thought I was in the Judgment Day. I think that's really funny, but does definitely take the edge off. So we'll see in the match, like if they can kind of elevate this to this sort of serious feeling feud again. Not to say like they have really much chance of that to begin with, just because it's R-Truth, but
this is huge.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe at the end of all this, like Truth is sort of like the person that you try to break up with, but they just don't accept it, so you end up staying in the relationship with them anyway.
Well, that takes us to the Donnybrook match between Pete Dunne and Sheamus, which got a bourbon sponsorship.
They are just an incredible marketing machine here. You know, I guess, you know, maybe they were trying to hit up like cricket bat companies, shillelagh companies, but they landed on the whiskey or bourbon company.
We had one of the most interesting activations where two of our superstars, Peter Dunne and Sheamus, with Small Batch 1792. And what we did, we brought it to life. The people in St. Louis, they could feel this bourbon sponsorship as it was activated. This is the kind of stuff we are trying to do more of. And we're going to do so much more.
They certainly activated it. Mr. Shapiro, thank you.
Yes. The match was activated, and Sheamus misses a brogue kick, hitting a whiskey barrel as Dunne hits a tornado DDT off of the barrel. For these guys, I mean, they made creative use out of this very basic bar room set that they had, complete with great-great-grandfather Sheamus and his photo here, and these barrels of what we can assume was Small Batch 1792 bourbon. They fought their way over to the desk, and Dunne is caught, slammed onto the desk. They come back from break, and Dunne ducks a brogue kick and introduces the shillelagh as Sheamus is climbing the buckle. Dunne hits a superplex, and then it's Dunne climbing the barrels but gets struck with the shillelagh, and Sheamus climbs on top of the barrels, hits him with the 10 beats on top of the barrels, and then a white noise off the barrels through two tables on the floor. This got a huge reaction. Sheamus cut up his elbow here, hits a Celtic cross, and Dunne kicks out. So Dunne gets the big weapon, the cricket bat. And Sheamus responds with it's Dunne who gets a drawer from the bar, breaks it over Sheamus's back, and then zip ties this guy with his hands behind his back. And Sheamus fights him off with his hands behind his back, kicking the cricket bat away, and then a brogue kick without the use of his arms, still pinning this guy in 12 minutes and 44 seconds as Joe Tessitore screams, "Outrageous! Utterly outrageous win!"
Does Tessitore have like a catchphrase call like from his other sports?
I don't know.
Yeah, no. Maybe he's
not,
still
not a Tessitore expert.
Maybe in wrestling he's still searching for it, and I don't know. Is that a leading candidate? Did that work?
Outrageous! Utterly outrageous! Outrageous. Yeah.
Did that? Yeah. No. Do you want to see the aftermath of this match on Sheamus?
Oh, I saw it. Sheamus.
Oh, look at this.
I mean, this man, Instagram was made with Sheamus's skin complexion in mind.
These two, I hope they got at least a case of that 1972 small batch. I hope they got a big batch, okay, of the 1972.
They didn't get any of the sponsorship money, I can promise you that. Jeez.
Yeah, I thought this match was way more than I expected, okay? Certainly, like...
picture Mark Shapiro coming up and slapping him on the back. Great job, man.
Oh, man. There were some really great spots planned in this match, especially towards the end. You know, just even, like, the spectacle of seeing, like, the 10 beats done up from that elevation I thought was really cool. But then they followed up with an insane white noise that, with that vertical drop, with that amount of weight, like, did not look fun to take whatsoever. And I think you saw the result of that here on Sheamus's back, but a very good TV hardcore match that I think I'm sure satisfied the sponsor.
The most important factor, I'm sure that Small Batch 1792 was gave this like 4.25.
Not to mention all the extra promo they get on podcasts like these.
I'm kind of conflicted if like I even have to name these companies. Like they're like, we don't smell a penny of this. So you know what? It's as far as I'm concerned, it's Jameson or Bust.
They're not paying us either.
Yeah, I know. I don't even know why I said that. We should make up our own. Kathy Kelly catches up with Cody Rhodes and is basically like, what are you doing here? And he can't speculate on what happened at Bad Blood. You'll find out more on SmackDown. He's here to, quote, learn about this crown jewel match. It's like, I think you were there at Bad Blood, and the clip pretty much was self-explanatory, but he's here to learn more. Cody then walks by Zayn, and Zayn explains that he plans to face Cody Rhodes at Crown Jewel, and Cody gave internally probably a chuckle. And,
sure, buddy. Yeah, sure.
Have you seen the poster? Zayn says, if you want to talk about anything, and Cody cuts him off right there when he's alluding to Owens, says, I want to face you two at Crown Jewel, and good luck. And that's that. Highlights of the last Monster Standing match, and this was the best segment. Sometimes we talk about, like, in storyline, the travel these performers have to endure. In storyline, Raquel Rodriguez, Liv Morgan, and Dominic drove from Atlanta to St. Louis, and earlier today arrived at the building, drove up, didn't care for Jackie Redmond's question, turned around, and drove off.
Well, listen... Okay, they're big enough stars. All right, they have other things to do.
Like what? Like drive for hours?
Yeah, I mean, maybe they just have a great evening of, like, I don't know, chicken nuggets ahead of them in St. Louis. They're way too big stars to be disrespected by Jackie with this line of questioning.
So the question posed to Raquel was if she is a member of the Judgment Day, and she wouldn't answer. Yeah. So then,
You know, we they certainly love their Shawn Diesel pairings, and why wouldn't they? You know, it's sort of a classic thing that's worked. We've got Nia and Tiffany over on SmackDown. Now this is something for Raquel to do. It's a role that worked well for her in NXT with Dakota Kai. So I think it's
her second Diesel go around.
Yeah, it is. Now she's got the sunglasses though, so that makes the difference. I mean, the jury's still out on how well Raquel will do here, but the fact that she's not smiling all the time anymore is already a huge improvement.
You are not allowed to smile now. You must look pissed all the time. Mm-hmm. Pierce is hanging out with Ava, hyping up NXT tomorrow. Ethan Page walks in, and he wants to course correct after CM Punk got into his business and cost him his title. And Pierce explains, I didn't make that match. Ava did. And Ava pretty much told him to go kick rocks. And then Sexy Red walks in. Ethan Page was not impressed with her and blew her off. And that was that.
So what do you think we're getting? Are we getting more Punk on NXT? And in what context?
I think we're going to have Ethan Page complain about it for a while. Maybe you get a GTS spot at some point. Maybe you get something with Punk.
So you can't see a Punk match happening on NXT?
I don't know. That seems a little too much for NXT.
Seems kind of big. They've been very conservative with their CM Punk matches. He's only had these three with Drew. Yeah. And he is also telling this sort of layoff storyline, isn't he?
Yeah. But it's some ammunition for Ethan Page to complain about on NXT for the time being. And
can you see Page getting called up sooner than later?
I was surprised to see him here. No, it would not surprise me if he's on kind of that fast track now that he's lost the title. You could do a rematch of Trick, but I feel that one's kind of been we're at the end stage. I think, you know, he got his run with the title. I guess we'll get a sense tomorrow. Like, that's, it's not out of the question that Paige gets the call up. Tough time though to be called up. Just given the limitations that we're gonna see. As that takes us to our next match, a 10-woman tag with the Unholy Union, Pure Fusion Collective teaming up against Natalya, Katana Chance, Caden Carter, Zelina Vega, and Lyra Valkyria. Let's just get our entire non Rhea Ripley and Liv Morgan women's division on television for 7 minutes.
Pretty much, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So Katana Chance is working with the face mask, hits a tornillo to the floor. Everyone is just brawling from the get-go. Deville then yanks Natalya and sends her into the steps. We come back. Lyra is in. Vega follows with a code breaker. Stark hits the springboard missile dropkick. They're just going like a million miles an hour here. Deville kicks Natalya, sends her out of the ring, and it's Lyra with a blind tag to Vega and hits her guillotine leg drop to pin Deville in 7 minutes and 12 seconds.
So, you know, this sort of like multi-person tag format is something that really helped the SmackDown women's division back in 2016 when they first had that brand split. I remember, like, actually the women's division being, you know, one of the reasons to watch the show for a time, in my opinion, because they had like these great multi-person tag matches on a weekly basis. And this might be something that they're continuing forward. Personally, I thought this was a much more like positive outing for the mid card of the Raw women's division than other matches. It allows a lot of the pairings to be fresh, doesn't necessarily overexpose anybody, and still allows certain people to stand out among the pack. I noticed Sonya striking looked a bit stiffer than usual, which I think for a shooter gimmick is a welcome adjustment to her style. But this match, unfortunately, I mean, there's still so much damage done, in my opinion, for the women's division, that this still didn't get much of a reaction from this crowd. So I hope they continue with the format, because I like the matches, but creative is where I think it still needs a lot of work.
Yeah, it just... It was just also rushed. Like, you had a lot of bodies out here. But I mean, you can, I do feel like this is sort of going to be your mix and matching of like women's pairings that are outside of this title picture, which seems like it's just going to be Rhea, Liv, and to an extent, Raquel now.
You're right. Yeah.
And then my favorite thing on the show. So earlier today, Turkey Al-Sheikh posted the Crown Jewel poster with the matchups for November 2nd with Cody and Gunther's faces prominent over top of Nia Jax and Liv Morgan. So everyone is looking at this as just a, maybe this came out 24 hours too early. And so they put the poster on the screen, and Joe Tessitore mentions how everyone is noting the Crown Jewel poster, but acknowledges that these were the matches when the event was set. However, the poster could change, and there they impose Sami Zayn's image over top of Gunther and explains this is what the poster could look like after this match. Highlight of the show for me.
Card subject to change, and you know, Photoshops could be made at any point in the build towards Crown Jewel. Yeah. I mean, listen, they were trying to make an effort to convince us that Sami Zayn had any sort of chance, and they tried. Yeah.
They should have put that poster out this morning and made it seem like a mistake.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
So they could have. Don't send Turkey the real poster until you want it out. Cargill and Bianca Belair state that it's time to get back to business, and they are ready to face Damage Control next week.
This was a much more babyface leading promo from Jade and Bianca than their last one. So clearly, like, seeing them on Bad Blood, I don't think they were supposed to be heelish at all. I don't know what that was, you know, 2 weeks ago.
But the big announcement is that on Wednesday on WWE's YouTube channel, they will debut, I didn't know this was even a thing, the Hell in a Cell music video will be released by House of Protection, where we will get to see highlights of this match done to the song It's Supposed to Hurt. Maybe this will feature the toolbox spot.
Maybe it will. Would you be disappointed if this was an entirely black and white video, like, you know, like with them censoring all the blood?
My question is, will this be coming out Wednesday, or is this going to be the next WrestleMania documentary?
This will probably, there's nothing controversial about this. I don't think anybody's fighting over the final edit of this.
That we're aware of. Right. And then the main event, I couldn't believe this. It's 9:40 and it's time for the main event. I'm just, great show. Gunther against Sami Zayn for the World Heavyweight Championship. Gunther is dominating him at the beginning. Finally, Zayn counters the sleeper with a blue thunder bomb. We go through two commercial breaks, and Zayn hits a Helluva kick on the floor against the barricade. Both men are down, and Zayn has to power Zayn into the ring, connects with another Helluva, and goes for a follow-up, but is cut off by a lariat. And Gunther tries for the power bomb. It's turned into an inside cradle. Gunther kicks out and hits a shotgun drop kick, hits the powerbomb, and Zayn kicks out. And this crowd's going crazy here, chanting for Sami. Gunther hits another lariat powerbomb combo. This time, Sami kicks out at one, and Gunther is shocked. So he applies the rear naked choke, and Zayn keeps the arm up. He's reaching and reaching for the rope, but then he gives way, and he falls back, and the match is called. And Gunther is the winner. And the poster is preserved.
Yes, yes. Sorry for whoever took the time to make that Photoshop. You know, put that one in the maybe
print it out and put it in the warehouse. It can be the posters that the match never took place. I'm sure there's a plethora of those.
Yeah, yeah. I thought this was an excellent TV match. I think these two have fantastic chemistry with one another. They typically have pretty good chemistry with almost anybody they face, but in particular with each other, I really liked it. Zayn, I think, is one of the best underdogs in all of wrestling today, and an opponent like Gunther is somebody that really helps showcase Zayn at his very best. I thought his lanky stature kind of like allows him to look like a rag doll when he's being thrown around by Gunther, and his selling to match was just very satisfying to watch. I thought his comebacks and facial expressions during those they were great. Like, there are very few who can kind of suck you into like a beatdown like Sami Zayn can. Nobody was really buying Sami Zayn at all to win this one, but they did achieve some really strong reactions by the end, and I think
this crowd was really hot by once they got into the near falls at the end for Sami. Like, it was a very hot crowd.
The kick out at one for the powerbomb was something I certainly wasn't expecting, and I think it's even being debated now that like there's an overuse of the kick out at one, but I don't think you see it that often in the WWE.
I like the one.
I love it.
When it's done well, it's a great spot. It can be overdone, but when it's timed at the right time, it really elevates things.
It was done well here. I don't know how often we've seen that spot attached to Gunther or at least this powerbomb, but here I thought it was perfect and maybe a bit of a moral victory for Sami Zayn coming out of this match as well. So, yeah. Now they're one apiece. So when do we get the third match? Montreal.
Yeah, yeah, maybe when SmackDown goes to 1 hour.
I don't think that's happening.
No.
They're building like a nice little long-term rivalry between these two, and I really do think like Zayn versus Gunther 3 should be hopefully for a championship that Gunther still has. I'd love it for it to take place in a Sami Zayn hometown.
There's one of my biggest positives I feel of this Paul Levesque-led WWE is that they book, like, there was a time you would see a babyface fail and it was viewed in such a negative way because you didn't have faith that there would be a redemption story or a follow-up. I think Levesque succeeds very well in booking defeat and that adds character to your babyface, and that there is that redemption story that's not going to happen overnight, but it is, like, that loss in Montreal was a year and a half ago, and it's referenced. I don't doubt there is going to be a time that Sami Zayn is going to have a huge match in Montreal, and that's going to be a multi-year story that wraps up. And I just think overall, like, you lose a big match, and it's like, well, that's where your character goes now. Like, it gives you this depth, and having those obstacles, that can be great, great story for a babyface to overcome, for a heel to overcome.
Well, look no further than Cody Rhodes at WrestleMania 39. I think that's the perfect example of just, you know, them taking a loss and turning it into a bigger business, you know, product for, look at me talking like a greater business activation than than you could have had. I think Sami Zayn, you know, Elimination Chamber 2023 for him will be his version of like Drew's Clash at the Castle loss or Cody's WrestleMania 39. It'll be sort of like the basis that forms the beginning chapter of his bigger story that hopefully will culminate with a championship win at some point.
What did you think about this 2 hour Raw and the format of it?
It was good. Good. Yeah. Maybe
two really good matches on the show.
Like you mentioned, maybe a little bit lacking in star power, but just a little bit. Like, I mean, you got Rollins, you got Punk. You're kind of missing.
You were missing quite a lot. It didn't really hit me until we were going through all the names, but it was also less felt in 2 hours. Like, to me, this was a show that felt a lot more faster paced, sometimes too fast paced, because there were the two very strong matches. I can't say, like, the totality. This was one of these, like, great episodes of the show. But there was, like, again, the 2 hours makes a difference, and you had enough quality stuff in there that I think you'd leave fairly satisfied. I'm very curious to see how this number performs when you're eliminating that third hour and what patterns we're going to see over the next month or so.
I'll say it's a show that I think, like, makes me want to come back for more of this rather than like feeling completely full. And on a week where you're trying to sell like 6 hours of like fresh TV, I think that's a good feeling to leave audiences with.
This is the best it's going to get, folks. 2 hours of Raw, no overrun on NXT, 2 hours of SmackDown. No collision this week. I mean, this is a very digestible week of pro wrestling where you only have to have like you might be able to have a semblance of a life and follow all of this instead of no life.
Enjoy it while it lasts.
All right. Some people have told me I complain too much about lengths of shows, but we all have our vices. So
you try being John Pollock, okay? And the amount of wrestling that
folks,
might
I'm in a hurry, man. Okay? I've always got to be somewhere, so that's it. Let's be quick and efficient as we go to our feedback.
Support for this post-wrestling podcast comes from those of you who have picked up our merch over at Chopped Tees. T-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, and hats from post-wrestling and our network of shows, including the NWA Podcast, Poison Rana, The Long and Winding Royal Road, WrestleNomics, and MCU Later. Free shipping to almost anywhere in the entire world. No minimum spend required. Tag us in a photo of yourself wearing our merch on social media, and I'll even send you a signed postcard while supplies last. That's chopped-tees.com/post-wrestling. Yeah, thank you guys for being here live at youtube.com/postwrestling. If you're watching us and you're not subscribed to the channel, do us a favor, hit subscribe right now. If you're listening to us the morning after, like most of you are, do us a favor and leave us a nice review wherever you're listening to this. iTunes. What is this, 2005? Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Or
put us in your top five.
Yeah, yes, please.
By the way, Andrew Thompson just posting this on the site. They've also added Jey Uso to tomorrow night's NXT for an appearance. So yet another main roster appearance scheduled.
All right. Very cool. Let's go to some super chats here from those of you watching us live over at youtube.com/postwrestling. Let's go to Bluey, who sends 100 rupees. Do you guys think CM Punk's WWE run has done enough to get him over the line in the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame? Also, thoughts on Cody's candidacy?
I've been open about the fact that I've been voting for Punk for several years. I will continue to vote for him. The WWE run didn't. I'm sure for some it's going to cross that threshold. My answer would be yes. I think Punk. It's a very like loaded category this year. The modern performers. And Cody is on the ballot this year. I think Cody's going to have a ton of support. At some point, we're probably going to do a more in-depth preview of the Hall of Fame. I would look at Cody as a very, very strong candidate. And I think Punk is a strong candidate. I will be continuing. Like once I vote for someone, I'm pretty much consistent. I'm going to continue to vote for them.
So like maybe to the best of your knowledge, what are people's arguments against putting CM Punk in?
I think the time away hurt him. I think that there has, I've always been very much on the side of promoting, or in terms of like feeling he has a very strong case for it. I think that the return to AEW to me, like put him over the top of just
the business. Freshness of All In and just the way he left AEW was that a big factor? Maybe
I'm sure that impacted people the way he left. And listen, you can make very strong arguments that as AEW's biggest star, which I feel is fair to say with CM Punk, that he did incredible good for AEW. He did incredible bad for AEW. Like you can certainly like the introduction could not have been bigger and the exit could not have been worse. Like that's but I think you have to overall just assess this guy, the influence he had during the 2000s, I think it had a great impact on the type of wrestling that was accepted on a high level in WWE. I think him and Danielson very much informed Paul Levesque's opening of his viewpoint about how to deliver an NXT product to a fan base that was not just your main roster consumption. I think that he was someone that, he was a gigantic merchandise mover, somebody that ascended to a very high level in WWE. I mean, he came in, he became a gigantic star in the company and then came out and he did it. Like I don't incorporate any of the UFC stuff into my thought process for this, but like if you want to attach like a number that he drew for a UFC pay-per-view, he certainly did that as well. But yeah, to me it was like I was already kind of there just with him and the influence he's had. This guy has been like the main character of professional wrestling, like no matter what It's like every couple of years he does something that is, he's like, for good or bad, like it's this guy has like stirred the drink of professional wrestling for such a long period of time. And I think for many people, like he is, look at the success he is having now. So I think he has a very strong case this year.
Thank you very much, Bluey, for that. Let's go up next to Kyle E. Coyote, who sends $5 to ask. Thank you for the support. He says, after Netflix's move, Pat rejoins Cole on Raw. What happens with Corey and Wade? Do they do a three-man on SmackDown, or is one of them no longer on commentary?
I mean, I don't even know if they've decided upon that. They could go to three.
Have they announced that particular setup?
I think they've already announced that, yeah, it will be Pat and Michael Cole on Raw on Mondays, and Tessitore would then move to SmackDown because college football will be done by then.
Gotcha. Such an interesting, like why swap essentially both teams, you know? Like, why not keep Cole on SmackDown and Wade on Raw?
I mean, I think they look at Cole and Pat as the A team that they want on Netflix.
Right. And maybe something with Pat on Mondays, maybe, perhaps, to fit with his
schedule. I mean, this could also, and I mean, you're going to run into the schedule issue like next season when when Tessitore is back to doing college football. And in theory, we'll have to move back to Mondays. Like, I don't think you're going to, like, you are going to have some musical chairs in there, but I feel there's going to be roles for Corey and Wade, and yeah, maybe it's just a three-man team with Tessitore.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Kylie Coyote. Let's go next to Matthew England, who sends $5 to ask, I hope Raw on Netflix is regularly 2 hours. Maybe they could do three-hour specials from time to time, and they can always do an overrun if need be.
I mean, I think the ideal scenario is that you can have the leeway, and there should never be a show where it's just dragging and you're trying to fill time. Like, that should be the value of Netflix, is that, you know, this week we have a 2-hour and 15-minute show. And next week we might need 2 hours and 45 minutes. And you know what? This week it's 1 hour and 50 minutes. Like, we should not have to be just like dragging out matches to be longer than they need to be. Like, I think people should be very hypercritical. Like, if they have that leeway, again, it's, you know, Netflix is looking for, you know, total consumption, like that's obviously to their benefit, but there's also, I think, the idea that this is a weekly product and you want to have the most fan-friendly product that people are going to be coming back to week after week. And I don't think it's insignificant if you see, like, if a decent enough percentage of people that are DVRing Raw are suddenly, like, look at our feedback we're about to get into. A lot of, like, Chris from LA, like, people that watch Raw for the first time tonight, because the 3 hours is a huge hindrance for people. And if it, and if you can convert some of that viewership into live viewers, then I would be taking that, if I'm Netflix, as a signal of what is the ideal runtime for the most live engagement.
Yeah. Those DVR viewers, I wonder how they're going to feel when, I guess, depending on what tier of Netflix they subscribe to, they might not be able to skip commercials anymore using Netflix, you know? So that's going to be a bit of a change for some people, at least.
Yeah, and we're going to see how that figures into Max as well. Mm-hmm. Like, it's going to be simulcast, and you would think, like, they're, like, if I'm TNT, I want the ads running on Max, regardless of with your, like, what tier you're at. But this is, yeah, this is all the stuff they're going to have to navigate with streaming components.
I have to assume there's going to be a ballpark, like, length that you're going to get a bit more consistently, just for the value that I think they want to present for the paying customer that's live. But, like, I think what their freedom to play around with that length is somewhat exciting. Like, the occasional match that might go, you know, 20 minutes longer than you would have expected, I think would be really cool. Thank you very much, Matthew, for that. Let's go, at least for now. Lastly, Owen York, who sends £2 to say, Triple H, I asked my questions a week too early. I think Owen is alluding to him asking some type of question that's similar to maybe the conversation we had with Chris this on today's show. So I'm sorry, I don't remember what the question is right now, but I guess Owen was early to the topic.
All right, let's go to forum.postwrestling.com, and we're going to start things off with Manny from Pacoima. Gunther and Sami delivered another great match. I asked myself before if there was a possibility that the Saudi government would want Sami walking into Crown Jewel as world champion. Seeing as the Crown Jewel will only be contested for once a year, I wonder if the champions will carry them on the show or just be awarded the belts, kind of like the Owen titles that AEW has. Do you think plans for Braun changed? We talked about that. He set his sights on Gunther last week. Do you also see two-hour shows sticking to the four-match format like tonight's episode? I think it'll depend, but that's typically the match order that you get for SmackDown each week. It's not going to be a hard and fast rule, but it's what worked out tonight, and I think it'll just depend. You can get away with more. You could even do less if you want.
It's not that I was counting, because I didn't even think about how many matches were on the show, but like, four feels like it would be the bare minimum, wouldn't you think? Like, even just like maybe forgetting about length of match, but just like when you're talking about watching a two-hour wrestling show, I feel like you would at least expect four matches. Like, three would feel almost too few, don't you think?
Well, for me, it's like it would depend. Like,
depends
if they
on the match
had
type,
not,
I guess, yeah.
Yeah, like it's... Like, if you're just going to put a two-minute match in there for the sake of things, it's like, no, I don't need that extra match if it's just going to take away from, you know, your main event, for instance. That, but, I mean, that's generally the amount we get on SmackDown.
I want to see a two-hour gauntlet for one of these shows, and we just have one match.
If we get one of those on Netflix, dear yeah. God.
All right. Will the champions carry the Crown Jewel titles on the show, or will it just be... I'm guessing they'll hold them for 1 week, and then I don't think you'll see them for another year.
I'm not carrying that thing around from city to city.
Yeah. Brian in New Jersey, quite refreshing to have Raw wrap up in 2 hours. Really good main event with a great closing stretch. Enjoyable Donnybrook match. Weird to see contracted talent Kevin Owens become persona non grata in the storyline so quickly. Good integration of Seth Rollins back into the show. Not looking forward to the rest of October being built up to the next Blood Money show. I would have looked into tickets for October 21st in Philly, if not for that.
Well, I mean, listen, you heard the response on Saturday's show. Like, there's a lot of that negativity towards those shows that exist all these years later. And yeah, it's certainly, you know, it's very prevalent among pro wrestling audiences that you really do not see that level of when it comes to boxing or MMA, where, I mean, a lot of the, especially in boxing, it's like, this is, it's viewed as like, man, there's all this money to put together all these great fights. And a lot of people view it very positively and are not like wrapped up in the, like the political side of things, of, you know, these shows being staged. But in wrestling, there is certainly that concern. It's not an insignificant amount of people when you're getting that level of response that we heard on Saturday, a very audible one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Brian, thank you for the message. Brian, we go to Muggin. It's going to be an adjustment after being accustomed to 3 hours for years. The constant commercials did hurt the flow somewhat. Gunther Zane was match of the night. No Goldberg. Thank God. All roads lead to Saudi. The opening segment flowed from Punk to Rollins to Jay quite well. If 2 hours means a lot less Judgment Day with a rotating roster, I'll take it. The Donnybrook match was also fun. Just a little more work on the pacing and they'll be good as gold.
And then lastly, let's go to Annie, who says, first time watching Raw live in years. The show was quite easy to watch, and I had a very good time with it. The Woods match was productive without being too bloated to expose Jay as a singles, and the Braun angle was very strong. The Sheamus and Sami matches were really good. The Punk Rollins tease followed by the Reed setup was well done, too. An 8 out of 10.
Okay. Well, there's everyone's feedback on this first two-hour edition of Raw in the past 12 years.
Wow.
Those years have flown by.
They really, yeah. I mean, shit. Like 12 years is a long time.
Yeah. Do you know where the first 3 hour Raw took place?
No. Where?
Same arena they were in tonight.
You're kidding! Wow.
Yeah. How about that? I think they planned it that way. All right, that's going to wrap things up. Thanks to everybody for joining us. Thank you to Dr. Chris Ely for joining us as well. Again, you can hear the NWA podcast every month at postwrestling.com. They are back a week from Sunday, chatting all the latest news and tons of great stuff from the NWA crew each and every month here at Post Wrestling. Queen of Villains review drops on the Cafe Tuesday, and Way and I are back Tuesday night with our special Tuesday edition of Rewind to Dynamite following Title Tuesday.
Title Tuesday. Yeah. And NXT's Well, Brayden and Davey will be back. NXT CW week two. So we're going to go head to head right on our own stream. All right.
Okay. Well, we're going to try that. We're going to test the limits of YouTube. So that's coming up on Tuesday. Thanks to everyone for joining us, and we will speak with you tomorrow.